Good morning. Let's go ahead and get started. This is a public rulemaking hearing held in accordance with the State Administrative Procedure Act, Section 244103 in particular, Colorado Revised Statutes. Today is February 6, 2007, and the time is about 9:05 a.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Conference Room on the third floor of the Office of the Secretary of State at 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State. I'm convening this hearing in accordance with the rulemaking notice that was published in the Colorado Register on January 10, 2007. The purpose of the hearing is to receive comments from the public on proposed amendments to the Colorado Secretary of State's election rules. As stated in the notice of rulemaking, the purpose of the rulemaking is to consider amendments and revisions to the rules concerning voting system standards for certification and to make technical amendments requested by the Office of Legislative Legal Services as part of their annual rule review process. In particular, Election Rule 45 is being revised pursuant to an order issued by Denver District Judge Manzanares on October 19, 2006 that requires the promulgation of a rule concerning minimum security standards for DREs as required by Section 1-5-616-1G CRS. In December, the Secretary of State's office distributed to the public and published on the office website a plan for the adoption of amendments to Rule 45, and as stated in that plan, this office enlisted the assistance of experts in drafting the amendments, and this group has helped identify some specific security risks and to define testing and certification requirements. And again, a copy of that plan is available on the Secretary of State's website. And on January 16th, the office held an informal public meeting in this room for the purpose of receiving comments on the initial draft, the amendments to Rule 45 as it existed at that time. And then subsequently, the office prepared a draft that was distributed to the public and published on the website on January 30th. And that version incorporated some of the comments that we got in connection with the January 16th hearing and comments we received shortly thereafter. So we're going to be working today off of the January 30th version of the proposed amendments to the election rules, and a copy is available on the table near the door. Let me do some introductions. Here at the table with me, I guess I'll start to my far right, John Gardner, who is in charge of voting system certification, Wayne Munster, Deputy Director of Elections, Holly Louder, the Director of Elections. Then to my immediate left is Dan Kopelman, Elections Technology Manager for the Secretary of State's office, and then Melody Murbaba, Assistant Attorney General. And then Hillary Rudy, from the Elections Division, who is a legal specialist. So some other housekeeping things that I want to cover before we get into public testimony. This is a formal rulemaking hearing. All testimony is being recorded. It's also being broadcast over the internet as well, and a recording will be available on our website. For anybody who wishes to testify, there are sign-up sheets on the table by the door. You do need to sign up in order to testify. When you testify, do identify yourself and who you represent if you do represent someone. For the record, our office has received some written comments. I have comments from Meg Costello, Associate Director for Colorado Common Cause, and also Susan Miller, Director of Elections for Jefferson County. And of course, anyone is welcome, in addition or instead of oral testimony, to provide written comments. As stated in the plan that we published in December, it's my intention that we'll leave the rulemaking hearing open, the record open, for 20 days after today's hearing. So, again, there'll be plenty of opportunity for people to provide additional written comments. And that's especially important because, you know, this is kind of a moving target in that there's been successive drafts, and the current draft was, again, was issued on January 30th. So I don't know for sure. I mean, it's 50-some pages long, as I recall. Don't know for sure that everybody has been able to study it in complete detail. So I do. It is really important to the office that we get the best input that we can possibly get, and that's one of the reasons for leaving the rulemaking record open for additional comment. So I think we have some people signed up. I'll go ahead and turn to public testimony and just basically call on people in order in which they signed up. The first person I have signed up is Michael Williams. Mr. Williams.
Good morning, all. Paul Holton, as you know, has been participating in the rulemaking proceedings, and he was called to trial unexpectedly in Wyoming, so we sent in the junior varsity team, so I'm not going to have much to say.
Right, thank you.
But I do have written comments from Professor Dan Wallach of Rice University, which I'll submit. I have six copies for your consideration. And the main thrust, as I gather, the clients we represented in Conroy versus Colorado, and as well as Dr. Wallach's written comments, is that we need to hold the vendors and their systems up to expert scrutiny while protecting their trade secrets, also having people with knowledge such as Drs. Jones and Wallach examine the systems and their security, and that's the main thrust of the several pages of written comments. I have not had a chance to gather Dr. Jones's comments, but given that the record will be open for 20 days, we'll do that in writing. And I'm also still waiting for comments on the disability access provisions from Noel Runyon, who's our disability access expert in New Mexico. So that's all I really have to say this morning. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Does anyone have any questions?
No. Yeah, thank you. Next, Meg Costello or Jenny Flanagan. Okay, yes, thank you. I do have your written comments. Thank you. Amy Storm, are you?
Good morning. Amy Storm, Mesa County Chief Deputy, Certified Election Registration Administrator. I, along with Sheila Reiner, the Mesa County Elections Director, are here on behalf of Mesa County Clerk and Recorder's Office. The Mesa County Clerk and Recorder's Elections Division has been utilizing electronic voting equipment, including DREs, since 2002. And I'm pleased to report that we have been able to provide accurate, fair, and secure elections for the citizens with that voting equipment. I believe that the voting equipment used in Colorado elections has been and continues to be secure, reliable, and accurate. That being said, there's no such thing as a perfect election, nor is there such a thing as a perfect election system. There are far too many fallible humans involved in the design, testing, operation, and implementation of any election to achieve perfection. Therefore, in order to reduce and mitigate our imperfections, we develop laws, rules, and procedures to guide us through the process of providing those accurate, fair, and secure elections. Such is the reason for the Secretary of State in developing this Rule 45 to test and certify for use voting equipment and systems in the state of Colorado. I think you would be hard-pressed to find an election official that would disagree with the need and responsibility to ensure and test the reliability, accuracy, and security of any voting system used in the state. I ask that the Secretary be mindful in the development of this testing and certification rule that the systems and equipment currently certified in Colorado have been proven through their use in Colorado and other states to be accurate, reliable, and secure. I'm unaware of a single instance in which a voting system was manipulated by an outside source or an erroneous result being certified within the confines of a live election with procedural safeguards in place. There have been rumors, accusations, and allegations made, and to quote Doug Lewis from his testimony to the EAC, Doug Lewis is the executive director of the Election Center, in 98.8% of the jurisdictions of America, the process worked so well that voter confidence rose to levels seen only before election 2000. Whether you are a congressman, or a senator, or an EAC commissioner, or a state office holder, or a local politician, or an election administrator, that is great news for America. If Americans ever lose their faith in the fairness and accuracy of the process, democracy will be lost. Some partisans continue to allege the process is broken, even in the face of such overwhelming response from voters about their confidence in the accuracy of the vote counting. From this point forward, we must insist that allegations have some proof with them. If no proof is forthcoming, then those alleging problems need to be told to produce proof or hush, end quote. The citizens of the state of Colorado have invested tremendous monetary resources in the proven and certified voting systems in use today. In Mesa County alone, the citizens have paid over $1.7 million to purchase certified and HAVA-compliant voting equipment and systems. I ask the Secretary to be prudent with this rule in not going so far beyond the federal standard as to be unable to certify any vendor's voting equipment for use in the state. It should not be the intention of Rule 45 to require standards that are beyond current technology available in voting equipment today or to set unachievable dates for the technology to be developed. When considering the requirements in this rule, we ask that the rule be written in a way that allows each elected county clerk of this state the latitude to do his or her job in making the best choice for the respective county's voters. Please do not negate the federal testing and certification and thereby require the further expenditure of more taxpayer dollars to keep pace with the ever-changing requirements. Thank you.
Thank you. And I do want to, if staff has questions, I want to provide an opportunity. But okay, thank you very much. You. And Sheila Reiner's also signed up. Are you okay? Yes, please come forward. While you're doing that, one thing I neglected to mention in my introductory remarks that I wanted to follow up on, at the February 16th informal hearing that we held, I announced that Secretary Kaufman did want to schedule a forum for people to provide input on voting systems generally, about what systems people preferred and what they saw as the pros and cons. And I did want to say that we will have the first of those meetings on February 15th, the morning of February 15th. In this room. I don't have further details at this point, but tentatively that's when we'll hold that. And I think the intent of Secretary Kaufman is to focus on electronic voting systems, you know, kind of, again, the pros and the cons, where this rulemaking hearing is a little more technical as far as complying with the requirements to come up with security standards and so forth. But I know that a lot of people have broader concerns about the right kinds of voting systems that Colorado ought to be using, and Secretary Kaufman is going to use that time to hear these broader concerns that citizens might want to voice. So, excuse me, Sheila, go ahead.
Well, that's okay. Thank you. I would like to submit some things. Everyone in written form as well. My name is Sheila Reiner. I'm Mesa County's Elections Director. I'm here on behalf of the Mesa County Clerk and Recorder, as already stated. Some of the strengths of Colorado's voting systems are the diversity of the software and pieces of equipment used within each county. With this diversity, someone who did have ill intentions cannot hack or manipulate anything without having source code and other specific information to each vendor and each piece of equipment used in the state. We urge the Secretary to certify as many different vendors as possible. We also urge the Secretary to put in place security at the state for retention of the vendor's proprietary information and source codes. If you do recall, our certification process was under fire for allowing vendors variance from these requirements. The probability is that our requirements still exceed the technology of all four vendors currently certified. It seems appropriate in this rule an allowable variance from the functional requirements to be defined from the rule and what is acceptable. The possibility is that 45.3.2 could state that an allowable variance from functional requirements shall be no more than 5% of the total requirements, provided that the variance is not deemed critical to the accuracy or security of the system. In Rule 45.5.2.4.2 and 0.3.
Say that one more time for me, if you can.
In 45.5.2.4.2 and 0.3, plus much of the functional requirements and security requirements, they are already tested at the federal level. The additional state requirements still today exceed current technology in some of the areas. Vendors should be given adequate time for gap analysis to be completed prior to the certification process beginning again. The supporting documentation for Rule 45 that defines the ballot to be used in the testing should utilize actual Colorado scenarios. The precinct numbers that are used should include districts in a logical manner, and the definition should be written in a manner to ensure that it can be set up for a Colorado scenario and provide for 100% accuracy. The test should be logical and repeatable. Please refer to the state of Florida's parallel test that was performed on ESNS Ivotronics just a few months ago that I handed out. The testing procedure and findings were all well documented, and the results of the tests were that the Ivotronics performed with 100% accuracy. While on the subject of Florida's testing of equipment, I would like to state for the record that there was no vote switching or vote dropping, as the critics would have you believe. The Ivotronics made from ESNS were found and continue to be found 100% accurate. The problem with the congressional race in Florida was about bad ballot design. For purposes of this hearing, please note that Hart Equipment services approximately 746,664 of the voters in this state. The Sequoia Equipment services approximately 804,035 voters. Election Systems and Software's Equipment service approximately 441,163 voters, and Diebold Equipment services approximately 994,953 voters in this state. I would like to also mention the statistics on a national level. As far as ESNS is concerned, 47% of the U.S. counties purchased and successfully used an election systems and software system to conduct their election in 2006. This equates to 44% of the voters across the United States who have been utilizing one of ESNS's voting machines. In Mesa County alone, we have been and continue to perform extensive voter education. The majority of Mesa County voters have embraced our voting equipment since 2002. Now Mesa County owns and operates the election systems and software Ivotronics with voter verified paper audit trail. I thank you for your opportunity to comment on behalf of Mesa County Elections.
Any questions for Ms. Reiner?
Mr. Munster.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. You mentioned that you want us, or you would suggest that we postpone certification until the vendors
at least make it clear what is actually required at this time and a certain date in the future that gives them enough time to comply with the requirements.
You know, one of the problems is we have to get the machine certified so counties can start purchasing this equipment.
Sure.
So, I mean, there's a conflict there. I don't know if you have any suggestions on
there is a conflict, but I just think that the rule as it is written today is unclear as to which of these requirements are truly, absolutely hard fast a requirement, and which ones are something we want to have in a system in the future when the technology becomes available.
Have you guys done an analysis of that? Or
Our vendor is currently undergoing an analysis now of what it's going to take to meet these requirements.
Oh, and will you share that with?
They're actually planning on providing that within the 20-day period after this hearing. They weren't ready for it today.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I have Gary Vandestoe, I believe it is.
My name is Gary Vandestoe. I'm the technical director for the Clerk and Recorder's Office of Jefferson County, formerly the Deputy Director of Elections, and intimately aware of the ruling because I was called as an expert witness for the state of Colorado. Although I have provided these written comments formatted slightly this morning, but not in substance, I would like to agree very much so with Sheila's comments. I think the real issue that we have here is we're not trying to protect a particular vendor. What we are trying to do is make sure we can even have an election in the state of Colorado. It is quite possible through these rules to eliminate all technology, and I've found several instances here where, as Sheila pointed out, it is too vague for the vendor to really know exactly what we're looking for. So I've taken a little bit different approach in, I'd like to cite particular issues that we have and perhaps pose some questions also. And the questions and the citing is already documented. The first off, and these issues vary from, we don't know that this is a possibility, to we're not sure exactly, and if we can't tell, how can the vendor really be sure of what's being asked for? And a lot of it is clarification to the point of we're talking about a vast array of systems here. When the rule refers to the voting system and says the voting system must have these particular aspects to it, and these particular security procedures that apply to these aspects, you're encompassing a lot of almost only mildly related products here. We're talking about DREs. DREs are going to have a specific set of rules. We're talking about ballot design and layout software. We're talking about reporting software. We're talking about the OCR or optical scan machines. And what I've found as I've gone through here is an overly broad definition that tries to lump all of those separate systems and all their separate characteristics, even among a single vendor, into one nice, easy rule that is supposed to apply across the board. What I'd like to see is a leeway to say, okay, this complies substantially in that it addresses what the issue is. My personal approach would have been to address these more as functional, what is the goal, instead of how exactly they must be accomplished. I think when you start saying how something must be accomplished, what you do is you open up holes to get around there, and then the next rules come along and they have to close up those holes. Whereas if you state the function or you state the goal, how that goal is achieved, if it is acceptable to Secretary of State, I think is a much better way to write things, in that it allows the latitude for the election companies to comply. And you've stated what your goal is to attain. I won't actually go through all of my comments here. an example of what concerns me would be 45.5.2.3.5.
Do you happen to know what page that's on our current draft?
Oh.
I know it's hard to track all these decimal points.
These are in sequential order as I have them, but I didn't.
Sounds like page 14.
14.
I'm hearing.
Okay. I'm sorry, I neglected to note that.
Like towards the bottom of page 14, I think. Referring to the ballot definition subsystem?
Yes.
Okay.
And the gist of the rule is that it's capable of formatting in multiple languages. The concern here I have is the subsystem shall be capable of being updated to format ballot system styles in additional languages as may become necessary under state or federal law. What you're doing there is you're saying we don't really know what the standard exactly is and what the test is going to be. You have an unknown future standard, and saying you've got to certify to that is, I think, problematic. The next section I'd like to address is, unfortunately, much closer than that. 45.5.2.3.20. And this refers to the ability for the machines to have battery backup. It requires that if you have optical scan in the polling places, and I don't know that it actually specifies this is a concern, saying optical scan devices, an optical scan devices is not necessarily in the polling place. What I use are large high-speed scanners, the ESNS M650. There is basically no way I can put enough battery backup on that thing to keep those up and running and counting ballots for 3 hours. Even with a large backup system, they draw a lot of power, and this may be an unintended consequence of this particular rule, thinking small ballot scanners as opposed to very large, high-power ballot scanners. What I can do is I can attain the ability to properly, in a power failure situation, to properly shut down the machine in a non-catastrophic way. The other issue I have is the DREs are, for DRE devices, this capability must include, at a minimum, for a period of not less than 8 hours, the ability to continue to present ballots accurately to voters, accept voter choices, and et cetera, et cetera. I don't see it clearly defined on what the load level is here. If we're talking 8 hours of continuous draw on these machines, you're continually voting for 8 hours on a particular machine. I do not know of any system currently on the market that has the ability to do that. For instance, the ESNS machines that we currently have, the iVotronics, they go into a shutdown mode, a power-saving mode. If the test is merely, can at the beginning of 8 hours these machines start up, run completely on battery power, can you vote, can you do everything you need to on them, and then periodically reactivate, and at the end of 8 hours, can they still be up and running? I'd say that is attainable. A constant usage is going to have the screen on all the time, and that's going to draw those batteries down very quickly. The county deals with this situation why we have trouble cars, and we provide batteries that are at different locations. If we have a power failure at a polling place, which is not terribly unlikely in any, for Jefferson County, we have 324 polling places. The likelihood that any one day the power will go down is not all that unlikely. It happens almost every time, and we deal with it in that we have a method in place to deal with that situation. To my knowledge, no system on the market can attain this standard without the use of additional battery backup. Now, saying that, since there's no system available, without using a battery backup, an outside battery backup, why do we set a standard to say you must do that when it's known that none can do that and you would have to rely on battery backup? It makes more sense to require, instead of this standard, require the vendor to come up with strategies or document strategies that would allow for this particular situation. Instead of saying the standard is you have to have 8 hours on batteries alone, knowing that's not going to happen, say you must have a strategy that allows your systems to run for 8 hours on batteries or a backup system. It is also my understanding that if we did have a problem with this, we can always move a polling place during the election day. That's a possibility. So that's another possibility to look at. I'll skip ahead to other things that, to me, seem almost unattainable, and maybe there are strategies for handling this. 45.5.2.5.3. Specifically, what's letter E, and it's referring to maintaining audit information. E requires that we are to log, or the machine is to log hardware events.
Excuse me for interrupting. I got lost again.
Oh,
could
I'm
you
sorry.
Repeat that?
45.5.2.5.3.
Okay. And somebody said 23. Page 23. Okay.
Oh, page 23. Sorry. Okay. Anybody ask page number, please? Help everyone out here. I've got the Cliff Notes version, so. Specifically E, again here, hardware events, add hardware, remove hardware. The new portion that's been placed in there is reset hardware and change hardware properties. So what I'm reading here is that a hardware reset is required to be logged. Well, to my knowledge, I'm not sure how a system logs something that is a hardware reset. Hardware reset requires a cutting of the power completely to the hardware. I don't know how you log that in real time, because by definition you shouldn't have to do a hardware reset if the machine is functioning. The machine has stopped functioning, it's locked up. I'm not sure how that would be taken care of. So an interruption in power would most likely preclude a proper logging of that event. Another indication of I'm not sure technology handles that situation, and that's irregardless of vendor. I'm just going to kind of vaguely go over 45.5.2. dot 6, dot 1, which is actually a very large section, and I'm not going to bore you with all the details of it. It refers to system access controls, database controls, operating system controls, basically. These requirements are too vague, and they do not take into any consideration the wide array of configurations and separate and independent functions of the voting systems. This is, as it states, applies to voting systems. Do they apply equally to the ballot definition system, the reporting system, the DRE, as well as the optical scan machines? When the rule is referring to the database on the voting system, that's something that doesn't really exist. We're talking about multiple databases running on different hardware and different portions of the system, and each has its own individual security risks, different operating systems in most cases, and it just is a little too vague and too broad. It's kind of a catch-all. So what I would suggest is the specific requirements that are relevant to their unique functions and associated security requirements. I by no means am saying that we shouldn't have the security requirements, simply suggesting that they need to be specific to the type and the purpose of that particular portion of the system. Further along, I believe it's in that same section, starts with C, states the voting system shall meet the following requirements for database security here. And it refers to all voting systems submitted for certification shall be hardened to the NSA guidelines for database hardening. Which I guess what I need is a clarification, because II after that says, well, if those don't exist by 2008, then C3, which if that one doesn't exist by that time, then you're supposed to harden it to the vendor specification. Well, it appears the NSA guidelines for database hardening, to me, must not currently exist. Otherwise, why would you have a second and third paragraph here? If this is correct, why would you specify to a non-existent standard? And it also supposes that the NSA guideline, which that may or may not exist at this point, I'm not sure, would even address what you're trying to address here. A noble goal, I'm just not sure that it's something that's doable by the vendors. It's a vague goal. How are they supposed to change to meet this? And the third option there is to just let the vendor specify. And I don't know that really accomplishes the goal that you're trying to do, because in the case of perhaps ES&S, they may use a proprietary database. So, man, I don't know this for sure. They could specify what their hardening level is. So it's extremely vague in a current concern there. Same thing for D, has the same wording. The next section I'm looking at in this is, I believe it would be V, and it states the voting system provider shall disable auto boot and auto run features capable by operating system. Auto run means for the system not to take an action upon the inserting of removable media. Auto boot means any operation required to place a computer into its normal starting operating configuration after power is supplied to the hardware. Now, by definition, as I'm reading this, the ES&S iVotronic machines cannot be used in Colorado elections because they do not have a power switch, per se. They are activated by the insertion of what would be considered a removable media. The removable media in ES&S's system is what's called a PEB, a personal electronic ballot. I don't believe this is what's intended here, but unfortunately I've dealt with enough contracts, this is what's written here. Perhaps we need to clarify that, because this refers to a computer. Another overly general term there. So in that case, that would eliminate the use of ES&S equipment, which would put 400,000 or so voters without a system to work with. VI, next one, would be the voting system provider shall use a virus protection prevention application on the election management servers / workstation, which must be capable of manual updates without the use of the internet. I'm not quite sure why this is a vendor responsibility, because they aren't the ones who are configuring or running the workstations for the election management. This is a county responsibility. I can see a requirement that says you need to document and suggest a proper system and demonstrate that, but to actually say they have to use it. They aren't using it. The county is. So that seems odd as a vendor requirement. I believe in the same section, VIII. Sorry, I'm not a great fan of the Roman numeral system. It refers to all voting systems against the cover all voting systems, which is difficult to actually figure out what's meant here. Submitted for certification shall have all components of voting systems capable of supporting passwords of a minimum of 8 characters, which shall be capable of including numeric, alpha, and special characters in uppercase or lowercase used in any combination. This is a good practice, but we have two problems here. First of all, it's too vague again. Referring to the voting system as if it were a single entity that can have a single set of rules applied. Secondly, if it's referring to a DRE that does not have a keyboard, all passwords would have to be entered via the touchscreen. A typical visual touchscreen keyboard does not display special characters or support the use of uppercase and lowercase characters. Since it is a graphical virtual keyboard, the graphic would be overwhelmingly large or unnecessarily complex. Furthermore, the use of a virtual keyboard is extraordinarily slow. To enter perhaps a 4-character password, as it is, without all the special characters in there, is running in the maybe 5 to 10 second range. Which in itself would preclude a brute force attack from being successful in a realistic scenario. I can understand something that is attached to a different system, such as a PC that has a keyboard. This is a much more realistic scenario, something that can be attached to a network, this can be scripted to try and break these passwords. But with, at least with the ESNS system, we're talking about approximately six different layers of passwords that they would have to break through. And the use of special characters and upper and lowercase is difficult because the system was never designed to have a keyboard. Again, it also catches perhaps an unintended effect here. What about optical scan machines? Am I required to put in a password for an optical character machine? A machine that has no display, it has no keyboard, and no way to interact with it in a password scenario. And in the case that we have these machines are, according to the new rules that we have last year, 24 hours a day monitored on video. They are sealed. They're in a locked and controlled access location. So the fact that it doesn't have a password really isn't that big of an issue because the first line of any security is always physical security. If you can't get to the machine, it doesn't matter if it's got a fancy password or not. You cannot get into it. We'll move on out of that section. So what I'm saying is that would preclude us from using the optical scan capabilities. And I don't think that was what the intention is here. All right. 4.5.5.2.6.3. Now, this is simply referring to the recommended policies or guidelines governing this. And the question is, what software for virus and spyware protection the voting system shall use? Again, we're referring to the voting system. Vast array of different operating systems. I think it needs to be clarified as to what portions of the voting system are you referring to. Is this reporting? Is this ballot definition? Is this the DRE? Is this the optical scan? It could vary in all of those situations, and it may not actually be relevant. Another one that may be only specific to the ESNS machine at this point, and I'm not sure. I'm familiar with most of the other machines, but this is specific. It's 4.5.5.2.8.1. And this actually isn't a new rule. This is an old rule. And it concerns audio ballots shall meet the following standards. The voting system shall allow the voter to pause and resume the audio presentation. And two, the audio system shall allow voters to control within reasonable limits the rate of speech. Now, the reason you would be using an audio ballot is if you were sight impaired. And for usability, our machines are designed to have a very minimal set of buttons. There's a forward to go to the next contest. There is a vote. You can review that vote, and it repeats. You can repeat as often as you like to hear that read back to you. But now we would have to basically have a fast forward. We'd have to have a pause button. And those cannot be accomplished in software because to put those on the screen, how is the sight-impaired person who can't use the screen in the first place supposed to know what button on a completely flat surface that they are supposed to push to control these things? If this is taken care of in by some sort of a bi-directional feedback that is with the headphones or the audio system, that's a concern for safety to me because Once you start bidirectional communication, you have communication going into the system. And anytime you have communication going into the system, that is an avenue as a security issue. Oddly enough, the next issue I note here, and I think this is under E, perhaps that same section, unless I've misdone this. It says, voting systems shall include at least the ability to activate and navigate by means of push buttons, keypads, and touchscreens by March 31st, 2008. Voting systems submitted for certification shall also include any form of either switches, sip and puff device, or additional blink control devices. My concern here, and it doesn't actually apply to me, is this, as it's written, requires that you have a touchscreen. Now, the Hart InterCivic system, which I don't have, and does not use a touchscreen. I live in Douglas County. I was able to vote very nicely on Douglas County's DRE, and there was no touchscreen involved. So I'm not understanding the inclusion or the requirement that a touchscreen be used. They have an entire navigation system outside the touchscreen. F requires a minimum adjustability by either the poll worker or voter of multiple color settings, multiple screen contrasts, and multiple screen angles / tilt if the system uses a display screen. Multiple color settings. Perhaps rewarding to the effect that if color is to be used on the ballot, multiple color settings must be available. We only use black and white ballots in Jefferson County on the touchscreens. That eliminates the need for color and therefore the need for color adjustment. Is that an acceptable alternative? And if so, perhaps it could be worded that way. There are many other questions concerning the same subject, such as, are the settings required to reset between voters? What ability the color palette are you requiring here? It says multiple. Very, very vague again. And I'm not sure that unless you are using color and perhaps you have an issue with a red-green color blindness, which I can understand here, you would need to go to a non-red-green color scheme if you were to use such a thing. Unfortunately, I'm getting towards the end here. 455.2.8.2. And this may be fairly minor. It says user adjustability of color settings, screen contrast, and screen angles tilt if the system uses a display screen. In most of the other portions, user is defined. User here is not defined. Is that the voter? Is that the poll worker? What level of user are we referring to here? So just a clarification. And I'll just do two more issues here, and that's actually skipping some. .5.5.2.9.17 states that as of March 31st, 2008, voting systems submitted for certification shall stop the VPAT printer of all forward operation of the DRE if the printer is not working due to paper jams, out of supply consumables, or other issues which may cause the correct readable printing of information on the VPAT record as designed. On its surface, that seems like a very attainable goal. If you start to think about it, this requirement is problematic in that there are undetectable printer errors, printer malfunctions that can occur, such as failure of the thermal print head. And I believe most of the printers are thermal print head technology, so you don't have a consumable such as an ink. You have the consumable would be paper, basically. Now, the printer cannot detect this malfunction. There would be in violation of this requirement. I would think that the fact that the print malfunctioning is visibly detectable by the voter, it should be dealt with at that point. You can't expect these printers to detect all possible situations, but this is what it requires here, all situations. Additionally, this requires a bidirectional communication with the printer, which provides another avenue as a security risk. And the last one, which is under 45.5.2.9.19, E, the printed information on the printed ballot or verification portion of the VPAT device shall contain at least the following items. And this is a modification of current on E. It says it must have the ability to optionally produce a unique serial number, and then in parentheses, randomized to protect privacy. Now, do you really want any ballot to be traceable back to an individual voter? This defeats the whole purpose of a secret ballot and opens up possibility of voter intimidation or coercion. As a rule, there should never be a mechanism of any sort that can track any ballot to any voter. No other voting medium has such a tracking number, and for good reason. I appreciate your patience in hearing me out. As you can review the printed documentation I provided, there are a few others, but I try to keep it a little less lengthy. So I appreciate your time, and basically our point is we have a concern that not all these specifications are unique enough to identify what the goal is. Too many holes, too many ways around a lot of these things, and it's quite possible that we could run into a situation where no one can be certified in the state of Colorado. That's another problem we have.
Thank you very much for your very thorough review. Are there some questions from the Secretary of State's office, Mr. Kopelman?
Yes.
I appreciate you taking the time to go item by item through this. I think there are a number of, as you mentioned, unintended consequences here that we may have put in here but want to address. I just wanted to run down a few of the items. The concern about 45.5.2.3.5, where the Voter Act was mentioned, Voting Rights Act.
45.5.2.3.5?
Yes. Okay. The concern about being able to address multiple languages. That, and also, I'm going to combine them together, the requirement for the operational time period with the batteries. I think what we were trying to get at was addressing requirements that are imposed on the state externally. One is there are going to be some counties that need multiple languages on ballots.
Yeah,
the other one is the problem with power outages that you mentioned and trying to ensure that a voter can vote. if we have, I don't know, something completely unusual like a large snowstorm that cuts all the power,
never have,
for example, to be able to handle that. The intent was to be able to address those. If you have suggestions and change in language to try to do that, or maybe we can look at ways of addressing it that still keep that in there as part of what the manufacturer does need to say, you know, what's the way of handling. That would be extremely helpful.
I agree. I think the intent that you're getting after, which is very commendable, is not necessarily what it says. So I was looking at it from the standpoint of what's really intended here, and is that what it says? And that was my concern on those.
The other thing that you had mentioned in a very large section that was too vague under the system guidelines, which is the starts at the 45.5.2.6.1 and continues on.
Right.
That may be my fault. We were trying to come up with a way to say we want to meet standards. We need to have a testable standard that can be met, and we needed to include best practices. But if we were to go through, and if you look at the copies, I think it has some specific registers for types of databases that it says this has to be disabled, that has to be disabled.
Absolutely.
If we go to that extent, then we limit the systems that can be made because they have to.
That also assumes that there isn't a new function that comes along with that. That's called something different in Vista as opposed to XP.
So the question is, when you said too vague, are you referring to us addressing specific systems, be it a desktop PC used for a database or a DRE? Is that the vagary that you're concerned about, or is it?
Yes. Because you've got vastly different operating systems that you're dealing with. You're talking about different operating environments, different times. You're going to have many, many different mitigating factors between a DRE, which has a very limited ability to interact, and the ballot tabulation server, if you will. You're light years apart. One is a multifunctional machine, and it has a much more complex set of issues, whereas you're talking about the DRE, which is at least a little bit more similar to a computer, but it also encompasses the optical scan machines. The optical scan machines, extremely limited in their function, their operating system. I would venture that many of them have completely proprietary ground-up operating systems to try and say, we need to turn off, say, ODBC connectivity within these isn't really relevant. And to say, okay, you've got to lock down this database and you must put passwords and you must encrypt and these different situations, you're not taking into account the particulars of the type of machine that you're referring to. To refer to, say, all vehicles are the same. Vast difference between a car and a bicycle, although they both have wheels. And if you were to say anything with wheels has to have these situations, there are so many different things that you need to deal with on a car as opposed to a bicycle. And trying to apply one overall set of rules to these is most likely going to have unintended consequences. And those unintended consequences could be the decertification or the inability to certify that particular system, because the system, as I understand it, is looked at as a whole. Certification comes in and they say, okay, we can't lock down this database because we don't have a keyboard and we can't put in anything else because it's an optical scan machine. There's not that latitude within this. It's kind of an all or nothing type of situation. That's where I refer to the vague descriptions. And what I would like to see is security requirements that take into account the specific vulnerabilities and address the specific vulnerabilities of the type of machines they're talking about, whether it's an optical scan machine. Now, they're going to vary quite a bit between a central count, which I have two of them, or if you have optical scan in the precincts, which you may have hundreds or thousands of the machines. Completely different security scenarios. And that's what I'd like to see, not such a broad definition there.
Okay, that sounds like we have a little more writing to do.
Any other questions? Mr. Munster?
Thank you for your testimony. That was enlightening. You know, it seemed to me you suggested one way to solve the problem, and I'm hoping you can elaborate on this. Give the vendors a chance to provide strategies to meet these requirements. What exactly...
Mitigating strategies. Well, they could be strategies along the lines of what was imposed on the counties for security procedures following just prior to last November's election. The fact that the vendor cannot currently comply with having a database to a certain security level maybe requires that a condition of the use of that machine in the state of Colorado requires a mitigating strategy by the counties. In our ballot preparation machine, we are, and all our servers and workstations that are involved in this, are completely standalone machines. They are not connected to a network. They do not have a way into them. They've got controlled access. They've got cameras on them. They're monitored. So the fact that the database doesn't have a particular level of encryption is really not relevant, because if you can't get to the machine, you can't break into the machine. And with the, say, the ballot definition programming, that is done completely separate on a machine from anything else. And we take that ballot definition and burn that onto a CD, and then that is moved over to another work area where we're talking, we use it for the reporting system or the programming of the machines. The fact that you can later go in and you could, you know, take a sledgehammer to the ballot definition machine is really of no consequence, because once the program has been set, that version is tested. That version is never modified without going through the testing process. That version is what we provide to the Secretary of State to have on record as the version we are using. The fact that you could maybe go into the ballot definition and change something is irrelevant, because that definition is never used again. We are already on a set, locked-in write-once media, and there's no connection between them, no physical connection. So those type of strategies can be seen as perhaps workarounds to mitigate the particular security shortcomings that are inherent in the machines. Now, I by no means am suggesting that these are not noble goals. This is a good document. It has good goals. But what I do see is a time sensitive issue here. This document is still in flux. It's not very specific, but you've got to allow the vendors time to to go through an evaluation, find the gaps, what do they have to do to change it, then actually go to the development. Then they need to go through the federal certification process. Then they need to go through a penetration analysis. And then it comes to you guys for certification. Well, all of these processes take time. They're very slow processes. They're not something the vendor can rush into, and nor would I want them to, because a quickly developed system is a system that's going to have more, be more error prone. I would rather it be thought out, have time to develop it properly, because I believe in discussions with ESNS, they support these changes, but they're not sure that they can make these changes in the allotted time. And what happens is, in Jefferson County's instance, we've already have $6.5 million invested into the machines, and we've been using them from 2002, and beautifully. They work very well. They have improved over the years. We do not currently have the VPAT system on there. We have the money set aside to put the VPAT on. But why would we spend another $2 million to retrofit if we don't know that the machines that we already have are even going to pass certification? So we're caught in this, can we buy it, can we not, and pushing the vendors to the point where they may not be able to make good changes. Or, as you see, there are things that I'm sure I didn't catch, and many other people didn't catch, that are unintended consequences here. So I would just suggest that it be written either to address specific security issues or address ways to mitigate those security issues that may be inherent in the current systems as they exist right now.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Vandestoe. Appreciate
you.
I'll skip over people that have signed up but not to testify, and at the end I'll come back if there's anybody else that does want to testify. The next person on the list would be Neil McClure.
Good morning. My name is Neil McClure. I'm with Heart Inner Civic. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. We've been participating in this process by providing comments back on some early drafts of this rule, and we appreciate that opportunity. And some of our comments have been incorporated in the latest draft. Rather than go through our individual concerns today, I think we'll all get lost on the decimal point system. We'd be more than happy to put these in writing and submit them after the hearing. What I'd like to do is maybe take maybe a higher level view of the rule and some of its potential impacts in some different areas, and then I'd like to close with some recommendations that you might want to consider as part of your rule revision that we see as providing benefit to the industry, both from a governmental level and a public level. I'd like to start out by just reminding everybody the original intent of the ITA process and the formation of that effort by the National Association of State Election Directors years ago was to replace a national single, to institute a single testing entity so that the state testing would go away. And this was part of, due in fact to the rise in popularity of electronic systems as they were becoming more and more complex, and the belief was that the individual states would not possess that expertise on staff to review and certify these systems. So as a vendor, what we've seen as our support for this national testing over the years is it's grown in complexity and cost and time, and now we're also seeing a groundswell back at the state level of separate requirements in many regards to bring additional testing to us. So as I share this with you, only that it's a challenge to the vendor community to try and keep pace with these changes and the costs and the time associated with this. Um, And as we've reviewed this, we've noticed that there's a lot of repeat or redundancy between the standards that EAC and NIST are proposing. Now, I understand that the time frames of the EAC in publishing and implementing their standards, we've been surprised by how long it's been taking as well, and I think there's a number in the election community that have been frustrated as well. So there's a bit of a challenge, I think, with incorporating some of the proposed language that the EAC has thrown out there into a state rule, as we've seen in the past, before publication and release and adoption by the EAC, that language is likely to change. I'll point specifically to the reference to the usability study that's quoted in your rule. It is simply a study at this point that's been published by NIST. We're participating in ongoing usability testing and standards development. We've donated equipment to NIST, and they continue to do testing. One of the challenges with that study is none of that's been vetted. It hasn't been applied and really codified to a testable level. And there are a lot of good ideas in that report. I mean, certainly we're keeping our eye on it and have our eye on the horizon as these items come to adoption. But again, I would just offer a cautionary note that this information is likely to change prior to its publication. In your proposed rule, you contemplate some independent analysis, and we've certainly interpreted that to mean some outside consultant that would operate in conjunction with the state to do some additional testing. Again, this is cost and time issues as we see it, and also additional requirements placed on the system that, again, we run the risk as being one-off per state. And that, you know, to support a variety of different approaches becomes not only costly and time-consuming, but also increases the complexity of our system. So these are things that we're concerned about. You do mention the penetration analysis and security weakness reviews, along with additional code review by this independent analysis. While NIST and the EAC are proposing language to address this, you've quoted some individual standards in here that I don't believe are currently contemplated by NIST or the EAC. But I would point out that both penetration and security weakness analysis are meaningless without a threat model. And a threat model defines what it is we're trying to protect against. And I'll draw an example to where you have, in one section, outlawed the use of ODBC after a certain date. Well, there's no information given about why this is not an acceptable approach. There's no information about what we're trying to protect. It's simply outlawed, and we as a vendor then need to go through the engineering analysis to determine a suitable replacement. Well, without reference to the threat that we're trying to protect, we could come up with a very viable and functional alternative that would be a greater security risk. So the importance of this threat model really helps to identify what we're trying to protect, and then there are options available to us to address that. So for example, we have implemented ODBC in a very secure manner. We've had that reviewed by independent consultants that are experts in systems security and have had them go through it and say, yes, in view of the threat model that we identified, we had to develop a threat model. In view of this threat model, this is a reasonable level of security. So I would really encourage you to take a look at some of the work that has been done related to voting system threat models. And that's a way, I think, to address a lot of the ambiguity in the requirements, is by not prescribing what needs to be done, but merely defining what needs to be protected against. I think this goes back to the strategy element of allowing a vendor to promote a security strategy in the face of these threats. So that would be a way to clean up some of those struggles. And I I compliment you on your efforts. This is, I know this is not an easy undertaking, having been involved in this myself for many years. The other challenge that we're faced with also in the terms of security, I mean, still security remains an art. You know, the challenge with security as an engineer, if you ask me if something is possible to happen to the voting system as an engineer, I will have to stand up here and tell you, yes, it's possible. But I also need to remind you, before we all get carried away, that it's also possible to be struck by a meteorite when you're standing in the voting booth. But we don't harden our voting booths. Why? Because that's a very unlikely scenario. So that leaves security as an art form, and you really need to develop around a threat model these mitigating strategies. And one of the challenges about voting systems is there is no match of commercial product to a voting system. Voting systems have a unique requirement for security and privacy that is not found in any other commercial product. So if you take a commercial standard that exists and apply it to a voting system, it requires modification and tailoring to the voting device because of these unique requirements. You reference OSS TMM, which is a penetration analysis commercially available standard that's used, and it's focused primarily on network connectivity as being the primary threat vehicle. Well, that doesn't truly apply one-to-one to a voting system device, and the TGDC and NIST have acknowledged this, which is why they've been working on an open-ended vulnerability model for voting systems. They're trying to tailor that to it. And so, you know, again, we get back to the timing of when they're going to come out with their standards and when we need them in place here in this state, and that's certainly a recognized challenge. Another thing that a threat model will do is help to distinguish between encryption and authentication. Throughout the standard, you use encryption and authentication as protecting data within the system at various stages. Personally, we do not believe a global encryption requirement is appropriate. Probably one of the number one reasons, whether rightfully or wrong, we have always believed, us as a company, that a lot of the data contained in a voting system, whether it be in the device or back at the central location, a lot of that information is public. And we're not sure about what the legal ramifications are of hiding that through encryption. And many times when you evaluate a threat model, authentication is an appropriate level of data protection and integrity. You just need to make sure it hasn't changed. And by globally encrypting all information, again, unintended consequence, is we get back to a huge cost to the system performance. I mean, you don't get encryption for free. It takes time and energy and microprocessor power and battery power to perform all these encryptions and decryptions. And you also add a whole layer of key management, which is a whole new layer of complexity to the system, and you have to factor that all the way out to the user and poll worker to understand how they're going to be impacted with that. So these decisions should not be taken lightly, which I'm glad to see you're not doing that, but it also should be done, again, in view of a threat model of what we're trying to protect. There's been some talk previously about battery backup power. We certainly are faced with some challenge with some of the requirements that are held in here for backup power. And one of the things that we've had to undergo as a company, I've actually either fortunately or unfortunately have been involved in the development of the eSlate from scratch, so starting out brand new, and have had to weather through the trade-offs and balances that are required to bring this product to market. I mean, the reality is this. Our product is built for five different customer demographics. The voting population, probably one of the biggest diverse demographics for any product available. Poll workers, election officials, and state and federal testing. I mean, all of these customer demographics need to be considered when making changes to requirements. The battery requirements, as they're proposed, don't appear to match up or align with the performance requirements that you're defining in here, and once again in the face of a practical election scenario. It's so important to establish a practical election scenario because you can establish requirements that are standalone, single element, dealing with this, for example, the performance requirements. But in reality, if you don't apply a practical election scenario, you run the risk of over-designing your system to satisfy this single requirement, which has both cost and maintenance impacts to that. So I would suggest in the case of this power backup issue is to develop what is the objective of running elections in the face of a power outage. You know, albeit an extended power outage has very low probability, nonetheless, they do occur. But as stated previously, I think battery backup and power is one area where that crossover between system requirement and procedural impact needs to be weighed, because that will have a tremendous end result impact on the cost of repeat elections. I mean, batteries cost money. Charging and maintaining the charge costs money. So do we want to over-design to meet a low probability event with a power outage that lasts for 8 hours when we haven't addressed polling place lighting or potential civil unrest after 8 hours of a blackout? But these are kinds of things that we need to factor in as far as a practical experience. And we've actually been through that. And as stated previously, many of the requirements in here do require additional definition. And when we review this, we are reviewing it from a mindset of an engineering problem. And so we're thinking through what the requirement says, how many possible different ways it can be interpreted, what's our assumptions about it, and in the face of not being able to get any feedback, which I don't think would be the case, those have to be interpreted. Well, those interpretations are as important as is what's stated in the requirement. And those, I would suggest, need to also be documented as you go forward for not only the current administration and staff members, but for the public to justify why this was acceptable functionality to meet a certain requirement. So those need to continue to be evaluated, and you know, one way to really evaluate a requirement as stated is to think through when you're writing them of how you would test for it. That is a very good litmus to determine whether your requirement is sufficiently designed to communicate what your objective is with it. How do you test that? If you can design a test for it, then the chances are of being it adequately defined are very high. There's some specific challenges, I think, that have been mentioned where there appears to be some system-dependent requirements, I would call. Certainly, I think we heard some statistics that there's really four manufacturers that are supporting the state today. We part runs the challenge that we're the only one that's not a touchscreen, which is for a reason. We're the only one that doesn't have a Windows-like operating environment on our voting system. We promote our device as a Maytag washer. It's an appliance. It's not a computer-based product. It's a microwave oven. And so we have little different requirements, and I think largely these presume everybody has a Windows operating system or Windows-like operating system, a multi-threaded OS, I believe, would be a more technical term for that, operating on the DRE. So we have some concerns and challenges associated with that as well. I'd say probably one of the biggest challenges with this is to evaluate the impact of these rule changes on a generic voting system model as a business model. We've come into this era and we have developed our business on a voting system model that did not contemplate some of the expenses and time requirements that are associated not only with these rule changes, but also with the EAC proposed guidelines. So those are very real issues, I think, for the entire election community as a whole. And, you know, I think they're not insurmountable, but I believe with the adoption of rules of this level, and, you know, this is comprehensive, and it's good to see. But that thought process needs to be part of the adoption, because we believe your intent is to elevate public trust and security in elections, not to drive people out of business or make them go away and obsolete investments that your counties have made. But I think it's very warranted to have discussions around the whole business model of voting systems. So that's what I would consider my more negative or directly toward the standard comments. Again, we have specifics that we'd be more than happy to draft up and share with you. As I said previously, I've been around this for a number of years and have come from different industries myself and have different industries experience. And with that, and having spent the time in the election industry, kind of identified some things that would really aid, we believe, in elevating public confidence and transparency into elections. The first suggestion to consider is require ISO 9000 and ISO 27001 certification. These are internationally recognized and adopted standards that would provide a framework for business, development, manufacturing, and security processes across vendors. They're very well known. They're very well practiced. It provides, you know, very well documented requirements of how a vendor does business, and there's some level of uniformity of which they can review across. So I think it would be great advantageous for the state to look at this as a possibility and look at bringing some uniformity across certification submissions. Another big challenge that this industry, I think, has been faced with is a reliability and mean time between failure requirements. Very widely practiced by other industries is something called a highly accelerated life test, which really has a test technique that tests products to the end of their life. It wears them out, and it also improves the product's reliability and by ferreting out potential defects that occur in the field. It's been proven years and years ago. This is why when you pull an HP printer out of your box, you have a very high expectation that you plug it in, it's going to work. That's why. They use this test technique, and it's very well adopted. Because reality, the news stories that you see about electronic voting systems failure, it's not about security. It's not about hacking. It's about unreliable systems that haven't been properly tested. Another one of my pet peeves is replacing logic and accuracy test with election simulation. Logic and accuracy test is a paper-based process. It was developed for paper. It's appropriate for paper. It validates an election setup based on a paper election, whether it's punch card or optical scan. And the reason is that code for those systems changes. For every election, it gets new code. And the only way to verify it's correct is to run a logic and accuracy test. DREs, on the other hand, the accuracy of the logic embedded in those systems doesn't change. From the minute it's certified, provided the code stays static, to subsequent election after election. And it doesn't provide a very meaningful level of information of testing about it. What is appropriate for DREs is to simulate an election. Simulation is a very widely used engineering tool, and it's a very straightforward manner to take your ballot definition, and while it may be unpopular, there is a way to manage of casting hundreds of thousands of votes and printing reports. And it's a very effective way to validate your election setup. Your equipment is operating. Your reporting templates are accurate, which is another bullet point I'll get to. But this is something that I would recommend that you consider. You mentioned in your rules about EML. You're on the right track. But another element that I believe will improve the election industry and the transparency and the auditability is the adoption of a standard electronic data interchange format, EML. And this is my opinion, so I'll take ownership of it, was developed over in Europe and was largely used for voter authentication and internet voting messaging. They've adopted internet voting more readily over there. It was developed in the UK. It does not have at its basis core structure the concept of a precinct, which is what our elections are primarily built on. And while an extensible language, if you try to take a core element and extend it, it gets unwieldy. The IEEE has a voting system, a standards group that has been working on electronic data interchange standard. It's called P1622. It's my understanding towards the end of the month they're going to release the first version of that standard for adoption. It's an XML-based standard. I would be remiss by not telling you that Hart InterCivic developed it and donated it to the election community. We have agreed to give up our copyright ownership if that standard is adopted by a recognized body. It's being used in a couple of states currently on the voter registration side. Adopt FIPS 140 as a DRE requirement. Let's just bite the bullet. Put a standard out there with an effectivity date that gives people time and require voting systems to be a secure computing device. This is a well-practiced standard. The testing is understood. It's been used for many commercial devices already. It's a good first step. And one of the challenges we're faced with are incremental changes. Incremental stepwide changes in the standards cause trouble because these are long-term engineering problems that we're trying to solve, take development, test time, and user familiarity. A FIPS 140 has been around for a long time. You might want to consider and look at that. And lastly, the most funnest one to bring up, which is probably the most unlikely, simplify the election laws. The complexity of voting system is due to, and no offense, Melody, taking what an attorney writes and trying to turn it into computer logic. It's wildly complex to try and interpret that and turn it into computer logic. While I understand you'd have to move heaven and earth to change laws to simplify them, one good first step would be to establish some standard reports. Standard reports that are adopted by the state that use not only the same information content, but also the same formatting. I can't tell you how many challenges vendors are faced with by changing the format or moving some column from the left to the right. A lot of these problems that are reported are not due because the information isn't there. It's because the last minute change to a report template wasn't adequately tested. If the state were to establish uniform report formats, I mean, it's all the same. You know, election information, we ought to be able to agree on a set of reports that are used by every county. Not only the content, but the format. That's a really good first step. And I apologize if I offended anybody from the county. Those are the conclusion of my comments, and I appreciate you from including us in your efforts. I believe you have many challenges ahead of you. And we're more than happy and would look forward to come in and discussing some of these issues more specifically and providing some engineering insight into the impact of some of these requirements.
Thank you, Mr. McClure. Are there any questions?
I'm sorry. One more thing. I do have a paper that was written in 2001 that's a little outdated, and it kind of addresses a logic and accuracy testing versus simulation. And I did fail to mention several years ago, we went through a very rigorous analysis by an outside company to implement a security architecture within our system, and based on a threat model that we developed. and that has been implemented. And one of the challenges that we've been faced with is there's nobody to look at it. We've developed a secure infrastructure for our voting system, but there's no vehicle for us to have that evaluated and assessed. And so I'm very supportive of what you're suggesting in here. We just need to do it with enough foresight to not cause the unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. There's a white paper written by the company that has done this review that I'd like to also share with you.
Thank you. I think Mr. Kopelman has a couple of questions.
You had mentioned the requirements to be tested for and the operating system specific elements. I was just trying to find out if you had a rundown of what's remaining. We actually did go through and try to assess it for that, assess the entire rule to address the specific requirements that we want to be able to test for and operating system specific elements. I was just wanting to know if you had a rundown of each of those based on the current publication.
Let me reduce those in writing to you. I don't want to go flipping through my tabs, but I'll submit that within the 20-day period that that was discussed earlier, if that's all right.
That's perfect.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next person that signed up is Jan Conan. Jan, did you? I wasn't sure whether you were going to testify, but it looks like you are.
Okay.
You didn't say yes or no. You didn't vote yes or no. Thank you.
I'm Jan Coonan, Chief Deputy Clerk and Recorder from Larimer County. I also wear the hat of Director of Elections for Larimer County. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to give you input into the rules that are presented here today. I read these rules, and my comments are directed in terms of when I'm in an election and I'm looking at this rule, can I implement it? Can I be in compliance with what I need to? So my comments are directed at a lot of that. I've tried to go through, I had several pages worth, and I have gone through and tried not to repeat anything that anyone has already mentioned here. If you would go to page 12, line 29. I believe this is where we're talking about election night results being sent to the Secretary of State's office during the accumulation of those totals. And I think I'm joined by Adams and Broomfield in saying that we really don't know how to do that. It is so time sensitive when we are trying to get the results posted at that time to be able to do an export and to get it to the Secretary of State's office. I truly don't know how we would accomplish that. The only thing we could figure out was that perhaps if an email would suffice, since we have a file that we do take off of the server, tabulation server, and actually put onto the network, we could certainly send that at that point. But I think we need some clarification there because I really don't know how to make that one happen. My next comment then is on page 13, line 7. Here you're talking about casting ballots and the requirements and the DRE touchscreen, 20 ballots per hour. I'm unclear as to what that means in terms, because earlier you've added 18-inch ballot with a minimum of 20 contests, which would be equivalent to the ballot that we just had for the 2006 election, and you could not get 20 ballots through in an hour with that. When we voted it, we timed it out, and we could not do that. So I don't know if you're talking about actually being able to vote that ballot there or whether you're actually talking about simply hitting a cast ballot button 20 times in an hour. So I think some clarification there would be helpful. Also on page 13, line 34, you've added, these must be sufficient on physical and design characteristics, and I'm not sure how one measures these must be sufficient. I did not understand the addition of that. Page 25, line 13. This is more of a question here, where you're talking about voting system providers shall not have administrative accounts or administrative account access. I didn't know if that would affect the smaller counties or not that do not do their own programming. It certainly would not impact us because we would not allow that, but I wasn't clear on how the small counties would handle that. And then page 60, line 5. Actually, that whole section there, I just join in what Mr. Vanderskow was saying there about there's so much of this that cannot be accomplished at this time that I fear that we are locking out some of the vendors who have had proven track records to point. On where you're talking about casting, the VPAT shall be capable of printing and storing 150 ballots, again with that 18-inch ballot with 20 contests. 72, when we tested for the 2006 election, 72 was the most that we could get on a VPAT. So I'm not sure 150 is realistic in terms of a standard to meet. And then page 71, line 21. This is acceptance testing, and I am assuming that means on new equipment purchases. John, is that what that refers to?
The acceptance testing would be for new or changes to systems.
All right, and this is talking about coordinating this with the Secretary of State's agent, which I'm assuming means that you want someone to come out and do the acceptance testing with us. That's how I read that. And then complete some kind of a form at that point. And the acceptance testing takes quite a bit of time. I mean, I know for us, we spent a good 3 solid days of about 10-hour days on the acceptance testing, and we only had 240 machines that we were doing at that point. So I'm concerned that if we are out of time and that you do not have adequate resources to meet all of the counties, that we would be held up in getting the acceptance testing done in order to proceed on with the election. And that's just from experience because we were running so close to the last election when we got our equipment there. Those are the comments that I would point out that have not been addressed already. I would join in what everyone else has said in regards to these. I think that we're making good progress. Be even better if I could read some of this, though, guys. It's getting so technical, it was like, oh, goodness gracious here. So I do thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Do you have any written comments? Pardon me? Anything in writing?
I do not have writing. I can submit if you would like.
Please. Okay. Thank you very much. I have one more person signed up, and then I'll, again, I ask if there's anybody else that wants to testify, but the last person signed up is Harvey Branscombe.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm Harvey Branscombe from El Jebel, Colorado, in Eagle County between Aspen and Glenwood Springs. We're in a small part of Eagle County, about 20% of the county that's separated from the rest by a lot of mountains in Garfield County. My qualifications, I spoke at the previous opportunity for public comments, by the way. I'm not going to repeat what I said there. Everything I said there still stands, and I think I've written comments that I've handed over in that respect. But I didn't mention my qualifications, so I'd like to mention that I have a Master's of Science in Electrical Engineering from MIT. I run a software company that sells a software product for the Windows operating systems which does backup and recovery, and it's sold internationally, primarily in Japan. We also represent in the United States, a German software company which provides machine vision tool sets for incorporation and other products. Unfortunately, it's a little too expensive to be used in a voting machine because it costs about $1,500 for the license for the software to go in the device. But it gives me a background of familiarity about the technology of what belongs in the optical scan devices and its potential limitations or opportunities for success. I'm also, I've been the co-chair of the Eagle County Democratic Party. I am on the canvas board of Eagle County, and I've served in several elections as the canvas board member. Basically, what I wanted to give a quick overview, and then I want to go into specific comments, and I have a lot of them. As you know, I presented my draft of Rule 45 previously with, I don't know, I haven't counted the number, but I know there were about 150 comments, and there are probably that number of modifications or more. And I recognize that at least one of you has read my comments, because there are a number of modifications in the current draft of the rule which appear to be based on my comments, and I appreciate that. Thank you very much for taking the time. What we're talking about here is not just about DRE, and it's not just about security. So I want to make sure that even though the motivation for opening this rewrite of Rule 45 may have been a court case and security, the fact is that all of the elements of Rule 45 should be open for review. And there are a number of areas where the draft needs, or the rule itself needs improvement and has needed improvement for a long time, for many of the same reasons that Judge Manzanares criticized the security elements or lack thereof. And this is the keystone of the election, the testing process. And I would say the federal testing and the state testing are what we're depending on to back up the claim that we have an accurate election. And since there's so little feedback to the voter, in fact, there's basically zero, a cash machine will give you some cash when you see the number show up on the screen. You see it's supposed to give you $20. It gives you $20, then you feel confident. Voting machine doesn't give you that kind of feedback. All you get is a county clerk reports to the press that there were so many votes counted. And it's these rules for certification that are the very basis for all trust in the voting system. Every time somebody talks about how voters have to have confidence in the voting system, well, it all boils down to what's in this rule and how well these rules were actually implemented in terms of actual testing and what that testing produced. And that's why we're here today. That's why I'm here representing the public. I'm not receiving any kind of compensation or much positive reinforcement for doing what I'm doing here. And you've heard from the clerks, you've heard from a voting machine manufacturer. I'm here purely because I asked the question, why should I trust the voting system? And the fact is I haven't lost faith in the voting system, I just never gained faith in it because nobody ever answered my question. Why should I believe that the voting machines actually count votes? And of course, possible answers would be somebody tested the machines, and sure enough, they did count the votes, and they were accurate to this much accuracy. But I haven't heard that. In fact, I've only heard that the voting machines were tested. Here's the plaque that you can see on the internet, and you can print it out and put it on your wall. But no information behind that about what tests were actually done, whether they were passed or failed, and to what extent they failed, what exceptions occurred. And I also understand that there need to be critics of voting systems involved in the process of testing and making the rules. And that's another reason I'm here, because I am a self-appointed critic of the voting systems and the rules. And so I'm here to try to ask the difficult questions And this is a very important role that someone needs to take, and hopefully more than one person would do so. And hopefully somebody on the, one or more people on the staff at the Secretary of State's office would take a similar highly critical view in order to counterbalance the natural pressure to have an economical voting system and not spend too much time at these hearings and all the other natural pressures that would tend to cause us not to dig deeply and, in effect, properly test the voting machines. So first, I'll just make some comments on what I've heard, since I think that'll be most effective. I heard that some partisans claim that the voting system's not accurate. Well, perhaps they're referring to me. I'm a partisan, but this particular effort I'm undertaking here is definitely nonpartisan, and there certainly are Republicans and Democrats and members of other parties who are equally critical about the voting system or equally questioning about whether or not it actually counts votes properly. I heard a challenge to produce proof that the voting system doesn't work properly. Actually, such proof exists, but the rules and procedures tend to leave the proof at the table of the place where it was first discovered, and that kind of proof does not get collected in any methodical way, and therefore it is very difficult to produce proof. However, since I have been a Canvas board member, I can produce proof of problems with the election system. And I have to say, in all fairness, massive efforts to try to overcome the weakness of the voting system and to produce a correct election on the part of the election officials in my county, the county clerk on down, and continuing efforts above and beyond what is required by these rules, and some of it motivated by my questions, and finally the clerk realizing that I'm asking, not only am I asking real questions, but the voting machine's not performing up to the standards that she was expecting, even assuming, and that we all assume that the voting machines have been tested and they are 100% accurate. But if you look under the hood, you find that the testing isn't really there to prove that, and the machines that are currently in the field now, there are machines out there that are incapable of correctly counting absentee ballots that have been folded, and I've conducted tests which show that, and the clerk in our county is about to conduct more tests to try to determine which of our voting machines actually do count accurately enough to depend on for a all-mail ballot election coming up. So there is, in any case, proof. It's just hard to get your hands on it because even I don't have time to write down everything I've seen, and I don't have a place to send it to. I don't know where. There are some websites and taking information about elections nationally. I've tried to communicate with some of them. Very difficult to communicate with them. It's difficult to get the information into a form to send it on, and it's difficult to get the time to actually do it. Those who are paid to do this job don't have the motivation. They have other jobs to do. Not among their jobs is the job to record the problems with the voting systems and procedures and to forward them on to a responsible party. And I'm hoping that outside the Rule 45, there will be some adjustments made here by the Secretary of State's office to encourage the collection, reporting and collection of proof of problems with the election system, because even though it doesn't at first hand encourage voter confidence, it's only responsible. It's the only way to achieve voter confidence in the end is to show that we do know what the problems are and we have dealt with them. So,
Mr. Branscombe, if I may comment, you know, some of the general comments that you're making, I think, will be valuable if you're able to attend the February 15th hearing. It may be a little beyond the scope of the rulemaking hearing right now, but I appreciate the concerns you're expressing.
Well, yeah, let me just move on more quickly through these other comments. The gentleman from Jefferson County mentioned that the rule, as stated, it often doesn't specify the standard, what the test is, and I'm fully supportive of that comment, and not just true of the security portions of the rule, but also the other portions of the rule. We really need to, and you can see from my proposed Rule 45, I tried to incorporate specific standards, quantitative criteria for success or failure of the voting system, and so I really want to support that. He mentioned the issue about the hardware reset. I think hardware reset is something that I proposed to, one of the things I included in my proposal. There is possible to leave behind, first of all, the audit function of the voting system should be such that any given system that fails, the information about that failure exists in another system. It's not a single machine, so there's a variety of machines that are connected together in most of these voting systems, not all, in most of them. And so the information of the audit log should be in a separate physical device, separate database. There's a reference to that in the rule, actually. Also, it's possible for the, if the system fails, for the last thing in the record to be that there was such a hardware failure. And when the system continues to work properly, that gets overwritten by an absence of that. So it is actually technically possible to produce an audit log that contains a hardware failure in it, even though nothing happens after the hardware failure. His comment about specificity is very good. About the auto run, that's very poorly written, the portion about the auto run. And all operating systems have some form of auto, there's two parts of that, the auto run and the boot up procedures. So all operating systems have that, and you can't eliminate that from the operating system. So that portion needs to be rewritten, as he pointed out. And then there's the issue about pause and resume for audio ballots. It's interesting that that rule probably never was fulfilled by the voting systems I'm aware of. And so apparently this is an indication where the rule was ineffective at producing a test during certification, which would have perhaps resulted in not certifying a particular machine, or there was some way that rule was bypassed. The portion about touchscreen is, I've noticed that problem, that it mentions that the voting machine must have a touchscreen. And I addressed that in my comments here. And the print malfunctioning is also something that's possible to address with some device that checks to see if the paper is actually being printed on. I don't think any voting machines actually have it presently, so it probably would be difficult for the voting machine manufacturers to have already included that, but it could be done. And finally, the serial number. It was suggested that serial numbers should never be placed on ballots for reasons of privacy, and I think that's the problem with that. It relates to provisional ballots and the possibility that VPATs will be used with provisional ballots, and I think that needs to be included in that consideration. Mr. McClure's comments, I have to say I 100% agree with his comments all the way down the line. He said, he mentioned that in the overall scheme of things, the ITAs at the federal level were intended to replace the state. I don't know if that's true, but I would say that if we could get adequate proof of testing, portions of testing done by the federal testing authorities that do actually accomplish the goal of the would-be state test, then perhaps the state test doesn't need to be, the procedure doesn't have to be performed at the state level. But the current level of documentation of federal testing is so poor, and at least from the public's perspective, it's non-existent, that one couldn't hope at the moment to have the federal testing replace state testing. The public has better access to the state testing, and it's terribly important that the state testing occur until that situation arrives. Better definitions are needed, absolutely. The rule has a great deal of extra terminology in the security section, and some of that I'm in favor of quite a bit of it because it is quite specific in many cases, and the balance of the rule doesn't have the same level of specificity, actually, although there's been some criticism here today about the lack of specificity even of the security portions that have been added. And the issue about the logic and accuracy test and its relevance to DRE is a very interesting question Mr. McClure brought up.
And in fact, I would argue that we do need a simulated election in the testing of voting machines in general, not just for DRE, but simulated election includes the idea of election conditions. And reproducing the procedures and things that will occur during the actual election so that failures of the procedures plus the machines will be learned in advance of the actual election. And that is what the test at the time of the logic and accuracy test should accomplish. And so I think he's right on there also. And he also mentioned that he says that security is not the major issue, that the major issue is failures of machines to be adequately tested. I couldn't agree more. That is 100% what the situation is today, partly due to the fact that the testing criteria don't really exist. And that's what I'd like to go on to. And by the way, I'd be happy to interrupt my remarks to let somebody else speak if they'd like to. I'd like to go through some of the, at least I feel since I didn't do this last time, I'd like to give a flavor for the kinds of changes I think ought to occur in Rule 45. And if there's enough time, I would go through the... So on page 6, there is of course, this interesting 45.2.2.2. Certifications issued prior to this date shall be considered valid provided the voting system meets the requirements of HAVA. Curious about what this seems to be related to the introduction of the HAVA restrictions in certification. And I'm not clear what effect that has in terms of the need for systems in place to be certified. And so it's a question I have open. I would have written that differently. I would say that systems need to be recertified because the certification rules have changed sufficiently and the previous rules for certification weren't really substantive enough to address the issues that I'm bringing up. 45.3.2, completions of items, though just the final portion of that paragraph, completion of items determined mandatory in the functional testing section of this rule. This is a big eye-opener for me. What does this mean, determined mandatory? Who determined? And if some things are mandatory, what are the other things? They're optional? This is highly problematic language for me. I'm only going to bring up the things that weren't addressed by you guys, obviously. 45.3.3, same page. Phase 4, certify, came out surfity. You can easily fix that. And section E at the bottom of the page, qualification report is mentioned here, as opposed to what I propose that a test log actually be produced, which shall be posted or provided to the public. And the Secretary of State's office prefers qualification report. This could be okay, but qualification report's not qualified. It's not mentioned what is a qualification report. And that might be the same thing as what's on the website today, which is a plaque-like document that says this machine has been certified. Page 9, 45.5.1.3, about two-thirds of the way down in the middle of the paragraph, it mentions that indicating the successful completion of all necessary ITA testing. I don't know why the word necessary is used here when I think that the word is required. That's what I proposed in my text. It wasn't picked up over here. And on page 11, this is a very important one, on section 45.5.2.1.8, subsection C, subsection VI. This is where the voting system is actually required to count votes. It says, the voting system shall include hardware and software to enable the closing of the and allow for the following: the number of votes counted for or against each candidate or ballot issue. This is not sufficient, actually, for reasonable auditing of the count of the votes. This has left out. Well, here's the phrase I would have used for this: the number of votes counted for or against each candidate or ballot issue, and number of undervoted and overvoted single-choice candidates or ballot issues, as well as the number of undervoted or eliminated by overvote multiple choice candidate or issue positions. If properly tabulated, the sum of the above count of votes for each race for any subset of ballots counted should equal the number of multiple choice positions for the race multiplied by the value in the public or protective counter. This is a very basic way of cross-checking whether the voting system has actually tabulated the votes correctly. And without having that requirement for the undervotes and overvote counters, you cannot perform that very simple audit, which any Canvas board member could actually do. And it becomes a great way to determine whether or not there is a one level of failure of reporting of votes all the way from the precinct level all the way up, or actually from the machine level all the way up. On page 12, 45.5.2.1.9, first full section, voters voting on DRE devices shall be able to navigate through the screens without the use of page scrolling. Features such as next or previous page options shall be used. I, having actually experienced a failure of a rather obscure failure of the HART system to fairly present the choices of candidates in the audio form of the ballot, would extend that to say the following. Besides what is already there, I would add, access to the opportunity to vote for candidates and issues shall be equal among them, with no differences depending on the direction of navigation through the ballot, position on the page, or other than the simple order in which candidates' names and ballot issues appear. Now, this just happens because I had the experience of doing the logic and accuracy test and found out that if you sequence through, and the HART system is different in that it has this wonderful rotating wheel, and that causes you to go from one choice to the next choice to the next choice, and they are in a fixed order, and you can't skip over them as you could with a touchscreen. And so it happens that if you go backwards through the list on the audio ballot, the last candidate doesn't get the same exposure as the other candidate. So that's why this type of criterion should be in the rule. This was mentioned before, the transmission of information from the election officials. I believe that it is necessary to be able to transmit the information even as the votes are being counted. And in fact, we know the votes continue to be counted for an extended period of time beyond election night, and there's no specific moment at which suddenly the votes are more finished than another time because different kinds of votes keep coming in. There needs to be a method for transmitting results not just to the Secretary of State's office, but to the public. And I think the public ought to be mentioned here in this piece. On page 13, there is now, and I thank you very much for including the specification that a standard ballot for the purpose of test should be a certain size. Actually, 20 contests was mentioned by the last woman who spoke from Larimer County. Actually, our ballot was 38 contests in Eagle County, so the 2006 ballot was actually considerably longer than this 20 which I think is the number I actually also proposed, which I think is a reasonable number, except that I think the criterion should include the length of text that's included in the ballot issues and the number of candidates, just to make sure that the screen size, resolution, the font, and so forth is adequate for presenting the ballot issues and candidates. And in fact, in this 2006 election, we had in Eagle County a ballot issue that required two positions on the ballot to accommodate it. And this was not considered to be a good thing by the voters, who found that they couldn't vote on the first portion of the text, but they could vote on the second portion. The first portion just didn't allow them to vote. And it was confusing on the HART system. You had to click through the first portion to get to the second portion, and the second portion could end up on the second page of the VVPAT, for example. So I would go for a more specification of what the ballot should actually contain for the test ballot for testing. the next section, 45.5.2.2.3, mentions equal or less than 5 seconds. I think this is a kind of long time to wait for something to respond. I think it needs to be a little bit better, just for the benefit of the manufacturers, actually, a better description of what these times actually represent. And if that's the worst case time for the machine to respond with some response during, I think this is during programming. That's what it should say, but the down below the in section D, view ballot image on screen is less than 30 seconds per ballot image. I have absolutely no idea what that means, why that would be 30 seconds. I would think 30 seconds might be an amount of time that would be the minimum that the ballot should be shown to the voter on the screen, but certainly not the maximum amount of time that would be required to bring the ballot to the screen. So that number just seems actually insane to me. And at the bottom of the page, you'll see this added text, these must be sufficient to accomplish the successful conduct of an election. This is actually the one sentence in the entire rule that works the way I think it should. It's the correct style of the rule. That is, the voting machine has to work to accomplish the election, and that's what this must means right here, and I consider that to be a very important word right there. I know someone else was objecting to it. On the next page, page 14, somebody else covered that. Going on to page 16, 45.5.2.3.14. I take exception to this section. It says basically here, it says the voting system provider shall include documentation concerning the use of touchscreen or other display and selection technology. What actually belongs here is the requirement that the touchscreen or other input devices should actually function correctly. And that's why I have replaced that with this kind of text here. All DRE voting devices shall use touchscreen technology or other technology providing tactile selection and visual and or auditory ballot display. The voting system, touchscreen, or other selection and display technology shall meet the following requirements. And then it says, if the system uses touchscreen technology, button or other tactile selection technology shall be sensitive to touch by a full range of conditions of wet and dry fingers, high and low humidity and temperature, high and low altitude, large and small fingers, weak and strong, quick and slow touch, etc. The sensor shall respond correctly in at least 999 out of 1,000 touches as tested during the certification test in a full range of above conditions. This is a class of thing that could be in the federal testing suite, perhaps. And if it were there, then I would be satisfied if the requirement were proven or the performance were proven at the federal level. But most likely it's not. And there is a reference to wet and dry fingers in the text, however, which was added, and I do appreciate that. There's a section on epileptic seizures. I thought that the voting manufacturer should provide proof that the voting device is unlikely to provoke epileptic seizures due to DRE voting device's screen refresh rate or any other visual stimulation. On page 17, at the bottom of the first incomplete paragraph, there's a sentence to the effect, the control subsystem shall be designed in such a manner as to facilitate the automated validation of ballot and software installation and to detect errors arising from their incorrect selection or improper installation. It seems to me that this is pretty vague. It's not, as I've heard that word before today. And I had some alternate text for that. It goes like this. The control subsystem shall encompass the hardware and software required to, in a secure manner, prepare voting devices and memory devices for election use. Is this the right? Actually, I'm just going to go past this because I'm having trouble finding my text. In section 17, in the middle of the page, There's a reference to the electronic image of the voted ballot. I believe that's referred to, that's defined as ballot image in the definitions. 17A, this is another key place where this is an attempt at a criterion for, a quantitative criterion for accuracy in counting votes. And I find it very, very lacking and quite useless and irrelevant. It talks about a maximum acceptable value for error rate, one part in 500,000 ballot positions. This doesn't really suffice to, this is where there should be a page of test criteria similar to what's been done for security in the Rule 45 draft. I think Mr. McClure, if he looks at this, he would shake his head because this criterion right here just doesn't make much sense. And there are a few other places in the rule where we have some similar stuff. We need to establish what the actual criterion is. I would say that. Processing accuracy. Right. Processing accuracy refers to the ability of the subsystem to receive electronic signals produced by physical expressions of voter intent to perform logical and numerical operations in response to these signals, which result in voter intent being recorded into non-volatile memory in the form of a ballot image, as well as a running tally of counted votes as specified, and to reproduce the contents of memory when required in every component and as a whole without error of more than 0.1%. The voting system shall be tested to determine if the error rates of the processing subsystem exceed the maximum specified in this rule. That's the level, kind of specificity I would look for. There's a section on memory devices, following page 18, subparagraph B. Memory devices that are used to retain control programs and data shall have demonstrated at least a 99.5% probability of error-free data retention for a period of 6 months. For operation and non-operation. This is going towards a mean time before failure type of criterion. It's not the way it's written. Here's a mean time before failure criterion. Memory devices are used to retain control programs and data, among which are voting system management and ballot image and tally data, shall have demonstrated at least an MTBF of at least 2 years at a maximum allowable bit error rate of one part in 100 billion over a period of 6 months. And that is a more reasonable criterion than 99.5% probability of error-free. It's not enough words there to specify what that actually means to an engineer. Jumping to page 20. 24. This is in the middle of the page. Voting system providers shall submit drawings, photographs, and any related brochure documents to assist with the evaluation of the physical design of the use of the voting system. I think there's something wrong with the grammar or the content here. This really doesn't make sense. As you can imagine, I have rewritten this one. The voting system provider shall submit the equipment itself for testing, as well as drawings, photographs, and any related manuals and brochure documents to assist with the evaluation and testing of the voting system. I think that's actually, the original one doesn't have much meaning, and the replacement is only common sense. Page 21, 45.5.2.4.3, there's an extraneous shall in this, right in the middle of this paragraph. On page 22, 45.5.2.5.1 at the bottom of the page under audit capacity, it says, voting system shall be capable of producing electronic and printed audit logs of system operation and system operators, which shall be sufficient to allow all operations and input commands to be audited. I think there's a word after operators missing, such as operators' actions. On the bottom of page 23 is the reference to audit records and where they are placed within the They should not be placed within the database. They should be maintained in a file outside or separate from the database. It's true that database is a word that's used rather loosely here, and actually this rule is very reasonable. It should apply to the physical location of audit records to be kept in outside of the systems which they're auditing, if possible. It's probably not always possible. And then you'll be happy to know that we'll jump past a huge number of pages here of added text for the security section, which goes way beyond what I would have proposed to include in this rule on the basis of the level of specificity of the remaining rule. So I'm not going to take time to go deeply into this. I found it curious that there's a reference to the operating systems hardened to the manufacturer's hardening requirements or vendors hardened to the vendor's specifications, because I think those are criteria which are nebulous in extreme, but I realize that they're intended to be interim measures. On section page 33, there's this reference to the auto-run features capable by operating system. And I think I mentioned that in my beginning remarks. At the bottom of the page, though, it says, all passwords shall be stored and used in a non-reversible format. I guess that means non-crackable or non-breakable format, but it's a little unclear about what that means. I think it should be elucidated. So you can see the 10 or 15 or so pages on security section, page 44, section XXV, top of the page, shall only contains, isn't English. Just want to make sure you know I actually read the whole thing. Skipping past. This is to page 52. Middle of the page, 45.5.2.6.2. This is a typical, actually this is still within the security portion, but this is typical of the old rule. Voting system providers shall provide documentation detailing voting system security in the areas listed below. I would replace that with a text that's a little more specific and not just limited to the documentation. You'll notice in a number of these places where the criteria for the voting machine is considered, it's not a criterion for performance of the machine, it's for the documentation to be provided about the machine. And the documentation could very well say, well, actually we don't have any security for this, or we didn't do this. That would actually satisfy this requirement as written. So that's where I wonder, that's what makes me wonder, without a test log, I'd propose a slight improvement of the test log definition to specify that the test log should be enough to allow you to reproduce the test if you aren't aware of how the test was originally done, and to be able to determine whether or not the test results actually met the criteria for the test or not. So all of that would be included in a test log. The test log definition as it in the document here is a little bit weaker than that, but the idea that a test log is required is a very, very good thing, and it's one of the huge improvements in the rule is that the reference to test log has been included in several places in the rule, including that the federal testing authority should produce such a test log for the benefit of the state. And I think that's just terribly important, and it's a clearly missing piece. But on section 45.5.2.6.2, I would propose the following instead of this. The voting system provider shall provide documentation detailing voting system security in the areas listed below. For purpose of certification, the voting system shall incorporate the specific set of procedures for the election defined in the SOS rules. Certification test must prove that the voting system integrates with these specific procedures in a manner which serves to secure the following operations. That would be the more specific way of putting that. The following page, there's a list of recommended policies or guidelines governing. At the bottom, there's a section for additional relevant characteristics. It doesn't say where these relevant characteristics would come from, and I think that would be relevant to specify. Now, it's my wishful thinking, but I would propose the following text: any additional relevant characteristics as determined by a panel of experts assembled by the Office of Secretary of State to analyze and to advise about specific requirements of the applicant voting system. On page 55, 45.5.2.7.6, this is about two-thirds of the way up. Any voting system provider of systems that cast individual ballots over a public telecommunications network shall provide detailed descriptions of. This is another case where meet or exceed does not appear in the text. I realize there are actually some additional, there are some additional text in here that cover that telecommunications topic. Jumping to page 57, accessibility requirements. In the middle of the page, section E is the place where the text should say and or touch screens, not just and touch screens, as mentioned before. Section G says all accessible systems will be tested to ensure device can perform the minimum requirements of election code and the Secretary of State rules. Now, this is a very fine sentence, which I think should be at the beginning of the document, except it for some reason specifies all accessible systems, and I don't know what accessible systems is not defined in the beginning of the rule. I think if you just drop the word accessible there and said all systems will be tested to ensure, that would be a great improvement to this rule. At the bottom of the page, documentation of the accessibility of the voting system shall include the volume following items as a minimum. Here's another case where instead of criteria for performance, there's a requirement for documentation to be provided. So I have a proposed text for that. Voting system shall meet the following standards for accessibility at a minimum. And among those, I'll pick out a couple that look like they need improvement. On the next page, 58, section B, adaptability of the proposed system for voters with the disabilities as outlined in the Americans with Disabilities Act guidelines. Outlined, this doesn't look like a criterion here. It looks like a pointer to a body of text that probably you can't test for accommodation to that outline or not. Section D, types and size of voice files the voting system uses. I would specify how many hours of recorded voice the system must as a minimum contain, and the choice of file types, minimum maximum size of voice files, expected recording time shall be documented with the application. So not that the manufacturer just provides the information. What are you going to do with the information? It only records 10 seconds of voice. Well, there's no rule that says it can't just record 10 seconds of voice, so maybe that's maybe we can certify it with 10 seconds of voice. But that's just not a criterion. H, capabilities of the voting system to accurately accept a non-human touch as input on the screen. This has actually been inserted somewhere else in the rule also. But what I would say is the voting system shall accept a non-human tactile input on the touchscreen and accurately interpret it. And we might even want to say how accurately interpret it, because most likely it won't be 100% accurate with a touchscreen, being that touchscreens need calibration. They have potential for error, there are parallax issues particularly with non-human touch, so perhaps a little bit more definition should be provided there. And I propose to add one extra piece to this list for accessibility to the following effect: the voting system shall accommodate correct voting by those with color blindness. Color shall not be a critical indication of information or differentiation. That she was referred to earlier today. And then we get into the VVPAT. So my one comment about the VVPAT is everywhere throughout this whole section, instead of referring to a ballot, we refer to a record. And I find that problematic, particularly when there's this one section here that talks about casting the record. And I'm not sure it's possible to cast a record, but you can cast a ballot. Obviously, I and the public would like the VVPAT to be considered the ballot and not the paper record. And that's a whole other topic. I think I've referred to that in my previous comments, so I'm not going to repeat that here. Um, 45.5.2.9.2, which is towards the second paragraph from the bottom on page 58, existing systems that are retrofitted to comply with this law shall be certified by the Secretary of State. That sounds like that maybe the certification's already been decided, and I would have proposed existing systems that are retrofitted to comply with this law shall apply for recertification by the SOS. On page 59. I think there are actually 72 pages in this, and we're actually getting towards the end. At the top of page 59, in the description of the VVPAT, section B, the unit or device shall have a paper record display unit or area that shall allow a voter to view his or her paper record. Voting device shall securely enclose the VVPAT while exposing it in a manner which encourages a voter to view and verify his or her ballot. That obviously, that's a qualitative criterion there for encouraging as opposed to discouraging the voter from seeing the VVPAT. In section 9.4. There's another place in 9.4 you could do the same thing. 9.5, the printer connection may be any standard publicly documented printer port. I have no idea why you would want this or what was the reason for this rule, but it's sitting in there. In section 9.11, towards the bottom of the page, is the place where you see the text that says it is not possible to determine which voter cast which paper record. Going on to page 60, the second paragraph, 45.5.2.9.14. I would add to that paragraph. This paragraph says, VVPAT systems shall be defined to prevent tampering with unique keys and or seals for the compartment that stores the paper record, as well as meet the security requirements of this rule. Additional security measures may be in place on the printer to prevent tampering with the device. Well, I guess this is suggestive to the manufacturer. I'm not objecting to that text, but I would add the voting device should be designed in a manner to prevent operation when the VVPAT is not functioning properly. And actually, I think you've picked that up and put that elsewhere in the rule also, now that I have my second reading. At the bottom of the page, section 19, there's a reference to the different things that need to be on the VVPAT, but there's no criterion for how many characters are the minimum desired to represent those races, and that seems to be a very important human factor of the VVPAT from personal experience. It seems that manufacturers may handle that by allowing the election official to adjust the font size, but I found in our elections in Eagle County that the descriptions of the races often truncated, and in some cases, only the first name of the candidate or the first and or the middle name of the candidate would appear on the VVPAT, which I think is problematic and probably a function of not this expectation for the number of characters in the ballot items being in the rule. On the following page, 61, this is where the ability to produce a unique serial number exists, and there are audit techniques which would require a serial number to appear on the VVPAT. And also, if the VVPAT were to be used for a provisional ballot, that also seems to be a need for a serial number for that. Section 19. I actually commented on this in 2005. This is about the rule requires 19 requires that the paper record should be filed no more than two times. This being the criterion for testing of the voting device and not the instructions to the election officials, I don't know why this specifies no more than two times, as if the design of the machine couldn't be should be preventing the us to change the rule to three times. This is just a at the leisure of the state, the Secretary of State rule, and it seems to me that the voting system should be tested to see that this can be an adjustable number. Otherwise, it's locked in the firmware of the device. There's no reason for it, actually. On section 22, following down, I would skip this section because it requires the VVPAT component to print a barcode. Now, I don't understand what the function of the barcode would be, and it opens the possibility for non-human readable processing of the VVPAT, which I think is inappropriate. Section 23. A voter may not be able to leave the voting area with the paper record. That ought to be will not be able to leave the voting area with the paper record. In section 24, here's the section on provisional ballots. So I rewrote the section as follows. If used for provisional ballots, the VVPAT system shall do nothing to obscure the full voter intent and must only additionally indicate that the ballot is considered provisional and to be handled separately in counting. The electronic cast vote record, the ballot image, and the ballot itself must be associated with each other and made available for a later decision as to whether or not to count certain races subject to results of future or further research into eligibility as provided under a section of the Colorado Revised Statutes. And moving on to page 62. I guess it's going to take me another 5 minutes to complete. Is that okay with you?
Okay.
All right. Thanks. Top of the page, 45611. This is a section referring to the demonstration of the exact proposed voting system to the Secretary of State or his designee prior to functional testing. Voting system provider shall demonstrate the exact proposed voting system to the Secretary of State or his or her designee prior to any functional testing. This demonstration and the subsequent functional test shall, to the extent possible, conform to conditions and circumstances of actual voting. And this is where I'm getting at the election simulation concept. It should be expected that a minimum of 6 hours should be required, as written in the current rule. The voting system provider to demonstrate and assist with programming of the software as necessary in preparation for functional testing to be performed by the representatives of the Secretary of State in absence of the manufacturer. I think it's dubious that the manufacturer is actually present and involved in operating the equipment during the test, and I think this ought to be revisited. The following section, there's a portion down here about hardware diagnostics testing. This is not specified, but I believe this is one of the key places where we need improvements in the rules. The reason I believe this is because of my personal experience in Eagle County working with existing certified machines that are not performing up to any reasonable specification. And I know they're not only because I was able to do logic and accuracy testing on specific machines with enough ballot repetitions to determine that the machines were miscounting. These, by the way, are Diebold AccuVote 2000, so this is an old technology, and I'm probably not talking to any of the manufacturers here, but the fact is that blank ballots been folded and run through the machine in a test that actually simulates the election conditions of absentee ballot returning through the mail. We process these ballots by folding the ballots, putting them into envelopes, running them through a stamp machine to simulate going through the mail. And we found when passing these through certain Diebold AccuVote 2000s that votes would appear. Nothing visible on the page, and the fold is not crossing the oval on the ballot, actually, but just adjacent to it. So this suggests that, and we, having found that, we then tested other AccuVote machines to see how they would differ and found there were wide differences in the extent to which they would respond this way. And that has led to Eagle County both doing additional hand counting and additional hardware diagnostic testing effectively before using the machines in an election. But where prior, I think most counties actually consider this hardware diagnostics testing to mean the machine was turned on and its display came on, and it's, maybe it has a power on self test that says it completed. Well, I would suggest more is needed here to make sure that the machines are conforming to their expected performance. And this should be done not with the, should be done with a test suite of ballots with a known election, not the new election that's coming up, but a previous election where there's a known outcome from a, or the count of a specific set of ballots. And that's just for determining whether the optical scan hardware or the other kinds of technologies are actually functioning correctly. Or the other possibility is that the manufacturer could build in some elaborate subsystem that would perform that test, but I think it's rather difficult to do so. But one or the other. The best would be the county would actually perform us. There is a hardware diagnostic test required, but it's not specified what it should be. And so, sorry, I'm spending so much time on this, but I think it's very important. Hardware diagnostics testing with the capability to demonstrate any differences or lack thereof in accuracy or sensitivity among several instances of identical voting devices. So this is just to determine that all the voting machines are working the same and as expected by the manufacturer. In the top of page 63, there's a series of criteria for different demonstrations. Anyway, there's no mention of preferential voting in this rule. And actually, preferential voting is in use in Colorado. It's in use in Basalt, Colorado. And Basalt, Colorado borrows the voting machines from Eagle County, Colorado. And it would be useful if the certification process actually made reference to these alternate methods of voting. Actually, the actual method of voting is not really laid out in the rule, but we ought to make sure that the machines that we're certifying today are capable of these beneficial methods of voting. In the middle of the page, on page 63, 45.6.1.7, the voting system provider shall provide the same class of workstation as the normal production environment for the state of Colorado. I would have put that the test should be done with the minimum configuration that's specified by the manufacturer for the suitability for the voting system. So, and I'm not, I have trouble believing that there is a normal production environment for the state of Colorado. So I think that might be difficult to pass that particular criterion. At the bottom of the page, voting system provider is not required to be present for the functional testing. You can imagine I changed a reference to that. And I'll just go on. Page 64, there's a little grammar problem here at the bottom of the first paragraph. Voting system provider after the established trusted build. There's a tense of the verb or something there. On page 64. Skipping quite a few of my comments, but I'm sure you'll be happy I'm doing so. This original document was provided electronically. On 6224 on the same page, there's a reference to simulated ballots. I don't know why that there's a reference to simulated there, when in fact the what's being tested should be a ballot. There's a somewhat of an absence of the requirement that some of these test results be put into the public record. And that's why I modified section towards the bottom of page 64.223. A test log of the testing procedure shall be maintained and recorded on file with the Secretary of State to become a part of the public record. This test log shall identify as a minimum the things that are mentioned in here, and a detail of all results of the test, including the exceptions found, whether or not they are corrected or correctable. So in other words, I'm proposing that the test log contain the actual results of the test, not the cleaned up, edited results of the test after any errors have been removed or somehow worked around or corrected for. All test environment conditions and procedures shall be noted, specifying in what manner these differ from actual election conditions and procedures. There's a set of general testing procedures on page 65, and I would add to that list of five, two additional ones. This is in 45.6231. F, I would add, compare all measurements against the standards provided for in this rule to determine the certifiability of the voting system for that test. Seems to be this is the most key part of the process of making the test, is to find out whether or not the system actually met the criterion. And then G, assign the pass or fail identifier to the appropriate test in the report of certification. So those just seem to be two missing elements here in what would otherwise be a great test procedure. In 45.6234, there was an improvement made to this text. It says, each component of the voting system shall contain provisions for verifying it is functioning correctly and whether operation of the component is dependent upon instructions specific to that election. Test scripts shall be substantive and qualitative in form with expected results listed for each test. I appreciate the slight improvement here on this rule, but I would go a little bit further. And here's what I would say. Each portion of the voting system functional test shall contain specific procedures to be taken and results to be expected in quantitative and qualitative form. The scripts for these procedures shall be such that the boundaries of any reasonable expected range of election parameters are tested. So this means that the test is not just a basic election, but it's a test of a variety of conditions of an election. Very important for to prepare county clerks and other election officials for circumstances that weren't imagined at by the Secretary of State during testing. So best to have them have the broad set of test criteria tested for.
On page Branscombe, are you pretty close? We were scheduled to conclude at noon, so I didn't know whether I don't want to cut you off, but
I have about actually eight more items here.
And we do have those, I think, right? I mean, I think the ones that you're reviewing are ones that...
No, I'm willing to stop now, actually, if you like. But the point is that the public doesn't get, unlike Mr. McClure, maybe he gets a little bit better give and take from the Secretary of State's office than the public does. And I have to drive my 3 hours from Eagle County to come down here for my one moment to actually communicate, and I'm not sure whether... The contents of what I provide by paper actually, I know it did actually get read by some people, so that's very good, but I think this is the function of this venue to do this. So,
well, I don't want to cut you off. If they're important, if you could go through them pretty quickly, though.
Well, I'll just flag what they are then.
Okay.
Well, page 66, there's a description of how many ballots. And I had proposed that the number of ballots for the test should be related to the size of the average election in Colorado based on the number of voters that appear in the average among counties, and then subdivide all of these different numbers of ballots based on how many voters are actually voting, just to make sure that we're using a reasonable number that matches the actual size of elections in Colorado. And the removal of section 45.6237, I'm very much in favor of. That was... along the lines of kudos, who have removed the place where the voting machine manufacturer actually marks ballots for use in the test. That I can't tell you how happy I am to see that. Failure criteria on page 68 at the bottom says voting systems must substantially comply. I think it was mentioned earlier that's not well defined and probably should be. Bottom of page 69, Secretary of State shall conduct an annual visual inspection of all software incidents. This is important. Incident records maintained by each vendor certified to use in the state of Colorado. This is where there's a reference to an actual collection of problem reports, but it's problem reports that are collected by the manufacturer, and I'm not sure where the manufacturer is required to actually keep or make these reports, but I would improve that to provide for a annual review and publish of reports maintained by the Secretary of State. And finally, in 45.9.2 on page 70, there's a list of places from which origin of the information upon which to base a decertification request. It does not include any member of the public there. And it seems to me there should be an extra entry there to include some experts from the public as a possible origin of information about or canvas board members, elected officials. There's many categories of people interested in the election who are not included in the list. I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Are there questions?
I would like to pose my offer to help in the process of crafting this rule, and I'm willing to do it without pay, actually. So if you are interested or willing, either I or someone like me, I think ought to be involved in actually crafting this rule. And also, we should take a longer-term view of this and not just the rule should be revisited again with some of these criteria in mind, because I know that this is not going to all happen in this round of revision of this rule. So I just encourage to think that this is not the end of Rule 45, that we need more work on it. Thank you very much.
I think that's right. And again, as I said last time, I really do appreciate all the incredible amount of time you put into this. And this is very, very, very valuable. Were there questions for Mr. Branscombe? I guess not. So thank you.
Just like the clerks do, but from the public perspective, I have my own body of knowledge about the actual when the rubber hits the road. And I'm very sympathetic to the needs of the clerks, by the way, because I have been right in the middle of it, and I know exactly how tough it is and how impossible it is to kind of the clerks don't actually have to. This is what the Secretary of State's office has to go through. This. Not the clerks have to go through logic and accuracy testing and on and on and on. Very complicated, and I know at least I'm sympathetic and understand the limitations and the problems there.
Thank you, and I'm aware that the staff spent 3 or 4 hours looking at your comments from before as well. So and they are very valuable. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify this morning? I think that's everybody who had signed up to testify. Anybody else? If not, as I indicated earlier, we'll keep the record open for 20 days, which I think would be close of business on February 26th. And if anybody has any written testimony, we'll accept it through that date. And then I think that's it. If you have written comments, do they go to you, Hillary? Is that... So Hillary Rudy in the Secretary of State's office will collect the written comments and distribute them to staff. If there's nothing else, then that'll conclude today's hearing. For the record, the time is 12:03 p.m. Thank you so much.